They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. The episode in which there are jobs and vaccines and real-time fashion, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 22nd day of July today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. If this is Thursday, it must be first-time claims for unemployment benefits day. It is Thursday, and it is first-time claims day, and the number is going the wrong way. While continuing claims for jobless benefits are going down, that is, people are getting off unemployment at some point, the number of first-time claims filed last week bumped back up to almost 420,000. Thing is, best guesses from economists and analysts was for 350,000. Or, another way to put that, claims came in much higher than expected. And you hear us say things like that all the time. This or that report or earnings announcement or what have you was higher or lower or better or worse than expected. But come on. In the grand economic scheme of things, how much do expectations matter? Anyways, Marketplace's Mariel Segarra starts us off.
Economists come out with forecasts for all kinds of things. Jobs numbers, inflation, retail sales, construction spending. And lately, a lot of their forecasts have been wrong. Russell Weaver is a director of research at Cornell.
Predicting the future is a hard thing, especially when people are involved, because it's hard to predict people's behavior, especially during a once-in-a-lifetime economic crisis.
In this pandemic, there's just so much noise. Say you're an economist trying to predict retail sales numbers. Dana Peterson, chief economist at the Conference Board, says consumers are getting an influx of cash.
Last year, we had one round. This year, we had two rounds of stimulus. And then starting in July, we have checks that are going out to families with children. And so it's not always easy to figure out what all that money means in terms of how people are going to go out and spend.
But also, a lot of products are in short supply and may not be available to buy. Economists have started using different kinds of data to help them make predictions in this environment. Government numbers on vaccinations, Google data on where people are going, like the grocery store or train stations. And they're looking at things like restaurant reservations on OpenTable. But given all the uncertainty, what should we make of economic forecasts right now? Should we even expect them to be accurate?
I certainly think it's more accurate than throwing a dart at the dartboard.
Lindsay Piegza is chief economist at the investment bank Stifel.
Economists do work very tirelessly to create models, and we use that to predict as best we can.
And she says ultimately we should pay attention to these predictions, because policymakers do, and so do investors. Forecasts are often priced into the stock market, and when they're wrong, you can get big swings. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Speaking of the stock market, Wall Street today was kind of bland. TBH, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. After 4 months in a row of declines, sales of previously owned homes were up 1.4% in June. That is as compared to a month earlier, which would make it May. Tight inventory has kept home prices high, as we've been telling you. But even for people who aren't in the market to buy a house, rents are going up too. Cities where rents are high are a given, like New York and San Francisco, they saw those rents come down during the pandemic, but even they are starting to see rents climb back up now. And as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports from Austin, Texas, finding a place to rent in some other cities is starting to cost more as well.
Jack Durham is 23, just graduated from college at the University of Texas at Austin, and he's now looking for a job in finance in Houston. He and two of his college buddies are also looking for an apartment there.
It is crazy right now, and it's absolutely wild.
Durham says even when he and his friends find a promising place, the market is so competitive that they're losing out on spots listed at a price they could theoretically afford.
A big issue is there's, you know, two or three other groups of people applying for that place. So it becomes really like a bidding, like literally bidding, like in highest bidder wins.
Now, we've heard about bidding wars to buy a house in a hot market, but for rent? According to Zillow data, typical rent in the Houston area jumped almost $100 from last year to almost $1,500 a month. That's the region's highest year-over-year rent increase since 2015. And higher rents, by the way, bump up economists' inflation calculations. Now, while he's looking for that place in Houston, Durham is staying with his parents in Dallas. Jeff Tucker, an economist at Zillow, says a lot of younger renters did exactly that during the pandemic.
Now the reverse is happening, where people are going back out. They want to get a place of their own. It suddenly becomes a very competitive atmosphere to sign a new lease.
Another reason for higher rent prices is that developers can't build fast enough to keep up with new demand in some places. Jack Lieberson teaches economics at UC Irvine.
If you look at what cities are there good jobs, it's really places in the South and Southwest, like Houston, also places like Atlanta and Phoenix.
Those cities have also seen new rental construction, and he says because the permitting process is fast in places like Houston, developers should be able to build new properties and rents could eventually stabilize. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Back in L.A., though, I am. Woke up this morning in New York City. Wentz David Brancaccio and the gang do the Marketplace Morning Report. Check them out. Everything you need to know to start your business day. One of the things that's happening in the labor market right now is that we're getting what you might call a natural experiment on an especially pointed topic. Whether those extra federal pandemic unemployment benefits we have talked a lot about on this show have been keeping people from going back to work. 26 states, one led by a Democrat, 25 by Republicans, have ended or tried to end. Lawyers have gotten involved. But they have tried to end or ended the $300 a week in federal payments before they officially expire in September, and thus would oblige unemployed people to go back to work. So Marketplace's Kristen Schwab made some calls to business owners in some of those 26 states to see if anything's changed on the ground.
It's been a strange spring and summer for the hospitality industry.
I can't tell you how many beds our executive team has stripped and made.
Lisa Lombardo is the chief people and culture officer at HDG Hotels, which operates 20 properties in Florida. She says as people started traveling more and bookings returned to normal, staffing did not. The company tried job fairs. It tried an employee referral program. It notably did not raise wages or offer hiring bonuses. But ultimately, she says it didn't need to.
It was as if someone had turned on a water faucet.
Last month, Florida dropped the extra $300 federal unemployment benefit. And
from June 23rd till right now, you're looking at more applications probably than we have ever seen.
Now the hotels are staffed up, and she thinks it has to do with those extra benefits ending. But there's not a lot of data out there yet to give us a definitive answer. Because of the way monthly unemployment numbers are tracked, we won't see what's happening now until August or September. We could look at job search activity. It's up in some states that have ended the extra benefits, but down in others, according to Indeed, a current marketplace underwriter. There's also unemployment insurance claims. Again, murky. Andrew Stettner at the Century Foundation says in the week ending July 3rd, claims actually fell by a higher percent in states maintaining the extra $300 than they did in states that ended them, which means
there's some other factors at play. For one, finding childcare is still a struggle for many parents, especially if the difference between a parent's paycheck and the cost of childcare is slim. Which brings us to the next point. Job openings right now are concentrated in low-wage hourly work.
It's a natural trend that the jobs that come available early in a recovery tend to come first available at the low end, and that's not the right job for everybody.
The right job. That's on so many people's minds as we exit from lockdowns and remote work and, let's face it, a deadly pandemic. And for many, a post-pandemic life means a departure from pre-pandemic careers.
And I think that people have thought long and hard about coming back to an industry that is challenging at best.
Liz Valenti runs Wheat Penny Oven and Bar in Dayton, Ohio, where federal benefits have also expired, though a lawsuit has been filed there to try to restore them. She says many of her loyal employees haven't come back, even after she raised wages by $2 an hour. They were concerned about COVID, about the tough hours, about how a bigger takeout business could mean making less in tips. In June, her hiring outlook improved. She had many more applicants. But a lot of people didn't show up to scheduled interviews. These were working interviews that were paid.
We would almost have a pool to see who was going to really show up for their tryouts.
It seems many were just applying to fulfill a reinstated requirement to keep receiving benefits.
It was kind of dark humor a little bit there for a while in June.
Since then, the extra unemployment benefits have expired, and she gets fewer no-shows and more people with actual restaurant experience. But not enough. She's still way understaffed. She's had to close 2 days a week.
And so we are leaving tens of thousands of dollars on the table over the course of a couple months.
Gary Burtless is a labor economist at the Brookings Institution. He says research from the Great Recession, when Americans were able to collect unemployment for up to 99 weeks, proves the labor shortage won't last forever.
When extended benefits come to an end, people do indeed search harder for work, and they're more likely to actually accept a job offer.
But he says this economic downturn is different.
It's going to be years before our research is going to sort through the evidence and tell us really what were the effects of this roller coaster of benefits.
Because this time around, recovery depends on a lot of variables. The virus, vaccines, and variants. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up,
for fast fashion, speed is really important.
When fast isn't quite fast enough. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 25 points today, less than 0.1%, 34,823. The NASDAQ up 52 points, about 0.3%, 14,684. S&P 500 nudged up 8 points, about 0.2%, 43.67. As we heard on the way into Andy Euler's piece, National Association of Realtors reported that sales of existing homes rose 1.4% in June, 5.86 million units, if you're curious. Demand for renovation is apparently strong. Home Depot up nearly 0.1%. West Fraser Timber grew 1.5%. Caterpillar down 0.7%. They heard from Kristen Schwab about businesses, many in hospitality, looking to hire. In states where pandemic unemployment assistance has ended, Hilton down 1.3% today. Yum Brands, home of KFC, Taco Bell, and Pizza Hut, up 2.9%. The 10-year, just to squeeze it in here, 1.27% on the yield. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. To vaccinate or not to vaccinate is the great divide in American public health right now. Not, to be clear, among public health professionals. They are all about vaccination. It's regular people who are the issue. But for a particular category of employee in this economy, that decision about whether or not to be vaccinated might soon get made for them. Two of the biggest hospital trade groups now favor requiring healthcare workers to be vaccinated as a condition of employment. And public hospitals in New York City have joined a growing number of healthcare organizations doing the same thing. There are some pretty obvious benefits to making sure workers are vaccinated, especially in healthcare, but mandates do have costs, as well as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports now from the Workplace Culture Desk.
It's hard to quantify exactly how many healthcare workers remain unvaccinated. One survey put it at a quarter. But any unvaccinated healthcare worker is too big of a risk, says Mike Slabowski, the head of Trinity Health, which operates in 22 states.
You know, if I go to the hospital or to the clinic, I expect that the people that are going to care for me are vaccinated. They should be. They have to be.
He says vaccines are the most important tool they have to keep patients safe. So Trinity will be requiring them of all staff starting in September. Such policies are legal and are nothing new in healthcare, says Robert Field, a health law professor at Drexel University. Many organizations, including Trinity, have required flu vaccines for years.
First and primary obligation of a healthcare institution is to safeguard the health and safety of its patients. First, do no harm.
But COVID vaccines, though they've been rigorously tested, haven't received full FDA approval yet. So some organizations have hesitated to require them, even after about 8 months of data and hundreds of millions of doses. And forcing mandates on healthcare workers could backfire, says Pat Kane with the New York State Nurses Association.
We're already dealing with a workforce that has been traumatized and has a lot of mistrust, you know, in the system that didn't protect them. And this is just going to exacerbate that.
One of the first hospitals that mandated vaccines lost more than 150 workers who wouldn't comply at a time when staff are stretched thin and facing a new wave of COVID cases. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Two things on the way to setting up this next story. Thing number one, electricity is a commodity. Might not seem like it, but it is. Gets traded like almost anything else. Number two, we out here in California do not have a great history managing the electricity we do have. See also rolling blackouts. We had them 20 years ago, made national headlines. We had them last year as well. But this past time, last year, California came up with a solution that is not sitting well with our neighbors out here. From KQED in San Francisco, Lily Jamali has more on that.
Many factors are responsible for casting almost a million Californians into darkness over two evenings last August. A heat wave, climate change, and poor planning. Governor Gavin Newsom made it known he wasn't happy about it.
And let me just make this crystal clear. We failed to predict and plan these shortages, and that's simply unacceptable.
What wasn't clear until much later was that California was exporting power, as in sending it to neighboring states in the middle of that heat wave. That was chalked up to a software problem that's since been fixed, according to California's independent system operator, which runs most of the state's power grid. But it went further. Elliot Mainzer is the CEO, whose main job is to make sure California doesn't have rolling blackouts again this year.
I think that we got to a good place for the summer.
California is the biggest importer of power in the U.S., but it also lets other states borrow its grid to transport power among them. Under pressure, Mainzer approached FERC, that's the federal energy regulator, and asked if California could hold on to power destined for another state in a pinch. And a few weeks ago, FERC said yes.
We haven't had to curtail yet any firm load. We have been able to allow those utilities to meet their highest priority exports while meeting the needs of the state of California.
Translation, California hasn't rerouted any power destined for other states yet. But utility regulators in other states, including Arizona, are outraged.
Last summer, we had more than 45 days that were incredibly hot, over, I think it was 105 degrees. So we are expecting incredible temperatures this summer and next summer. So in Arizona, that's a life and death situation.
That's Leah Marquez Peterson, chairwoman of the Arizona Corporation Commission. She thinks the change allows California to hijack power that Arizona has bought ahead of time and was counting on.
Arizonans wanted assurances that we wouldn't have rolling blackouts like California. So we've pre-purchased this power, yet in essence, California is taking it hostage as it's crossing the borders on their transmission lines. And that's not acceptable.
And while California has yet to withhold power traveling by way of its grid, Arizona's utilities are already rethinking how to manage when they do.
Every hour of the year matters. And that is especially true in tight, extreme conditions.
Justin Joyner is the vice president of resource management at the utility Arizona Public Service.
If that power is not dependable and allows another party to curtail it for its own needs, then from a planning perspective, I have to completely remove that from the equation.
Joyner says that means looking to other states besides California that might be able to share in the short term and in the long term, possibly building more power plants on its home turf. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
We want things fast. We consumers do. We want them fast, we want them cheap, and we want them right to our door. And increasingly, that includes the clothes that we wear. Enter then Shein. That's a digital native clothing brand based in China, which happens to be one of the fastest growing e-commerce companies in the world. You've heard of fast fashion, right? This is more like real-time fashion. So the other day, we got Matthew Brennan on the phone. He writes on Chinese technology and technology companies. And I asked him what exactly real-time fashion is.
Real-time fashion refers to the model that Shein's developed, whereby you're in the Shein app and you put something in your cart. When they upload a new item, they can actually update the systems that they have in the back end, whereby that action that you take can immediately have an effect on the factory floor. So everything from the website backend through to the supply chain management system is all linked together.
But the moral of the story is they're wired to get it from your phone to being made in lightning speed.
Yeah, exactly. For fast fashion, speed is really important. And if you're able to quickly spin up when an item's doing well, that gives you a sustainable advantage over your competitors.
You write that Shein is the fastest growing e-commerce company in the world. If it's so fast growing, how come it's not better known?
Shein's extremely well known within the demographic that it targets. Uh-huh. You speak to a woman under the age of 30 in North America, they will usually tell you it's a brand that they're very familiar with typically. But outside of that demographic, you're right. It's much less well known.
Do you think this, what they are able to do could happen anywhere that wasn't China, which has the labor force infrastructure for this. It's got the industrial infrastructure for this. This is sort of China specific, right?
They certainly do have an advantage in the supply chain for China. China's not the cheapest place to manufacture anymore. You can go to markets like India or Bangladesh. The labor costs are definitely lower in those markets. But China still has an overall advantage in terms of the speed and flexibility. And the overall package of infrastructure is still best in class.
Let me dig into the whole demographic thing a little bit, of which I am clearly not a member, and that's fine. But as we started getting ready for this interview, I went to the Shein site and I clicked around and there's a little tab that says men, and I clicked on that. And look, it's nothing that I'm ever going to wear. But the question is, are they looking to grow beyond women under 30?
Sure. I think, you know, when you look at something like this, you start with, appealing to one demographic, and then you can start to expand out from that. So that's exactly what we see Shein doing. You know, if we roll back the clock just a few years ago, yes, it was nearly all just women's fashion. Today, that's not true. The categories are much more varied. They have men's fashion. They have household items for your kitchen. So in several vectors here, we can see that they are clearly expanding their offerings.
So look, if you're the new guy running Amazon, now that Jeff Bezos just wants to go into suborbit, are you worried?
You could be. I mean, I don't want to mislead you into thinking that Shein is on the scale of Amazon. It's certainly not right now. But if you could think about this, you know, how would a disruptor to Amazon arise? You know, they're using a model. Their model is very, very difficult, perhaps impossible for Amazon to copy. And they're coming in with a price advantage. You know, if you roll back the clock 3 years, and if you'd said, you know, could a company come in and compete with Facebook? Most people in Silicon Valley would have said, no, that's not possible. TikTok from China has proven that that's possible. So it's not beyond the realm of imagination that Shein could do something similar.
Matthew Brennan, he writes on Chinese technology, also writes books about it, most recently a book about TikTok, as it happens, called Attention Factory. Matthew, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time and your insights.
Thank you for having me once again.
This final note on the way out today, tip of the hat here to Justin Fox over at Bloomberg, who's been perusing some new data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, something they do called the American Time Use Survey, which is literally a survey of how we spend our time. Anyway, there's a comparison in there of how we spent our time during the pandemic versus what we were doing with our time in the before times. My favorite highlights for the period May through December, 2019 versus 2020, right? End of the year 19 versus end of the year 20. We spent 18 more minutes a day watching TV last year than we did in 2019. Seems low, honestly. Only 18 more minutes a day watching TV in the pandemic. And on the less time side, we spent 4 minutes a day less on grooming during the pandemic than in 2019. That can't possibly be. Only 4 minutes less? No way. All right, we're going. Here, though, is your moment of economic context, a quick follow to that existing home sales setup for Euler's piece on rising rents. Also rising, the median home price, $363,300 in June. That is up, get this, 24% almost from a year earlier. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.